The clock is ticking for many of the world's glaciers. One in particular retreated fast a few years ago.
This was incredibly rapid, and it was something that had been suspected from computer models, but hadn't really been seen in detail before.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, what new research from Antarctica means for planet Earth. Also, we find out how humans have been dealing with junk in space.
We have been treating space the same way that we used to treat the oceans, you know, throwing all our trash.
Plus, a comedian from India tries out a different audience.
I'm not so Indian that I would study to be a doctor, but like, I'm Indian enough where I would never use a white doctor.
And the global reaction to New York City's mayoral election.
All that and more today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thanks for coming along with us this Wednesday.
His campaign grabbed people's attention across the globe, and now so has his victory. Zoran Mamdani will be New York City's next mayor.
Mamdani was born in Kampala, Uganda, to parents of South Asian descent. That is something he highlighted during his energetic campaign and in his victory speech last night.
To my parents, Mama and Baba. You have made me into the man I am today. I am so proud to be your son.
Now people in Kampala are celebrating his win as their own.
Hi, Zora. Good luck. Wishes. All the best from Uganda.
One reaction there from the Ugandan capital. American journalist Stephen Thrasher is there and posting people's reactions to Mamdani's win, as well as their messages for Mamdani on social media.
In Uganda here, we are very happy and grateful for this milestone you've made. And we understand that you will serve people genuinely from your heart, as you have been promising.
The opposition leader in Uganda's parliament is also taking note. It's big encouragement to us, even here in Uganda, that it's possible, lawmaker Joel Senyoni told the Associated Press, referring to the underdog campaign that Mamdani ran. Bold words with the country's longtime authoritarian leader Yoweri Museveni up for re-election in January.
In India, people are reacting to two key moments from Mamdani's victory speech last night. First, his nod to India's first prime minister.
Standing before you, I think of the words of Jawaharlal Nehru. A moment comes but rarely in history when we step out from the old to the new, when an age ends and when the soul of a nation long suppressed finds utterance. Tonight, we have stepped out from the old into the new.
That's a deliberate echo of Nehru's famous midnight speech delivered on the eve of India's independence from Britain in 1947.
In Delhi, the stage was set for British rule to give place to the new dominion of India.
In that speech, Nehru spoke to the people of India about fulfilling their destiny and awakening to life and freedom.
But the real kicker last night for South Asians was Mamdani's music selection as he walked off the stage. Doom Machale, a popular song from a 2004 Bollywood movie. As it played, Mamdani hugged his Syrian-American wife, his mother, Meera Nair, the Indian filmmaker, and his father, a Ugandan scholar. The internet went nuts. One person on social media called it a Bollywood movie IRL.
All a reminder that Washington, D.C. may be America's capital, but New York City belongs to the world. Three astronauts are stuck on China's Tiangong space station. They were supposed to head back to Earth today, but their spacecraft was damaged by debris, so now their return has been postponed indefinitely. It is part of a larger problem, space junk. Nilton Reno is a professor of climate and space engineering at the University of Michigan. He explained it this way.
Space junk refers to human-made material in space. Could be pieces of spacecraft that breaks, could be like the upper stage of a rocket, many different things. Could be material ejected by solid rocket engines, could be humans, material like a glove that was lost, many, many different things.
Yeah, and that is a fact. That glove is floating out there somewhere in space. I kind of think of rockets and those stages that fall off as they launch. What happens when you launch a basic communication satellite, of which there are many out in space? Are there stages that fall off that and float around forever?
Low Earth orbit, it's above about 200 kilometers. We usually define space as starting above 100 kilometers.
About 60 miles up.
Yeah, it's basically a place where, in order for an airplane to fly, it would need to go almost as fast as the orbital velocity. But there is a thin atmosphere because the atmosphere density decreases exponentially with height at low Earth orbit, like 100, 400 kilometers. So that drag would bring down space debris. But if you're above those altitude, space debris will stay for a long time.
So this news about damage to the Chinese space station, how common is it for this debris to cause problems for astronauts?
Much more common than people imagine. I can give two examples. One, SpaceX Starlink satellites. They were just in the news that in the last 6 months, they made about 150,000 maneuvers to avoid collisions.
Wow.
So those are warnings that there is another object, a satellite or a debris that tracked by the U.S. Space Command in their way. And like the Hubble Space Telescope cover that NASA brought after 17 years in orbit was completely covered by impact craters due to impact of debris.
Yeah, so you're saying there is so much debris causing problems that it's not all known.
Exactly. We measure only in low Earth orbit debris larger than a baseball.
So just to be clear, something smaller than a baseball, that may seem insignificant, but it can also cause problems, right?
Exactly, because like the high velocity that they are in orbit, about 10 kilometers per second, 7 low Earth orbit, a debris of about a millimeter in diameter, that's basically the diameter of a lead in a pencil, has as much energy as a rifle bullet.
Wow. Yeah, well, 6 miles per second is what you're talking about. That is going to cause a lot of damage.
Exactly.
Nilton, just as a side note, these Chinese astronauts are not at the International Space Station. Remind us why not.
They are in their own space station. Basically, NASA and the Chinese, they don't really collaborate in space. They are in competition with each other.
Is it possible to even count the debris from that explosion?
Not the smallest one. We can count the larger ones. With big effort from NASA using the Deep Space Network, they can measure debris of a few millimeter in diameter.
Wow.
But the ones much smaller than that can be hazards too.
So how long have we humans been leaving debris in space, and how much of this stuff is currently out there?
That's a good point. I think since the beginning of the space exploration, because, for example, Sputnik is still in orbit, I think we have been treating space the same way that we used to treat the oceans, you know, throwing our trash. That's why the ocean's full of plastics now, microplastics, and the environment around the Earth is also full of what you call space junk.
Yeah, so that's a really great analogy. And is there any mechanism analogous to limiting this littering that we humans have been doing in space?
Not yet. There has been lots of people trying to be proactive in that area, trying to convince the different countries, different space agents to come up with an agreement, but there's nothing now. The only regulation it has is the entities that approve launch of space vehicles to basically try to assure that the mission does everything that they can to prevent increasing the number of space junk.
Scientists have been sounding the alarm about this for years. What are the obstacles to dealing with the problem or having some kind of mechanism to deal with it?
I think people don't want to be regulated, like SpaceX, for example, launching Starlink now, about 8,000 satellites in orbit and a few satellites coming down regularly, like, I don't know is the exact number, but per month. And if there is a problem, a collision, that orbit will be full of debris. And the Chinese are planning to launch another 10,000. Space is getting busier and busier and busier, so who have to take care of this problem, otherwise it will get much more expensive to maintain things in orbit.
Professor Nilton Renno speaking with us from the University of Michigan about the problem of space junk orbiting around the Earth.
from real outer space to fictional outer space, I guess. I am talking about lightsaber combat. The glowing swords from Star Wars have been the centerpiece of kids' backyard battles for a couple of generations. But martial arts experts have invented lightsaber combat as an actual sport that combines fencing with fantasy. Would-be Jedis train, fight, and face off against each other for galactic glory. The world's Jerry Haddon reports from a lightsaber academy in Barcelona.
The first rule of lightsaber club, you do not talk about... Wait, that's fight club. The first rule here, before a duel, don't forget to turn your lightsaber on. ...39-year-old lightsaber instructor Xavi Yaguis lights up his 47-inch long weapon. It glows a soft blue and makes that classic sound.
Las espadas que utilizamos son una empuñadura de aluminio con...
The lightsabers we use have an aluminum handle, he explains, with a blade that's basically an empty plastic tube with lights inside it. It's strong enough to withstand blows, but flexible enough not to hurt your opponents. Or, say, evaporate them. Like when Darth Vader strikes down the old Jedi Ben Kenobi in the first Star Wars movie.
Empecé, pues como mucha de la gente de aquí, porque me gusta mucho la saga de Star Wars.
I got into lightsaber combat, Yagua says, because, like many of us, I'm a huge Star Wars fan. Ever since seeing the films, he says, I fantasized about having my own lightsaber. What kid didn't? But Yagua's desire only grew with age. 7 years ago, he finally jumped online, where there are zillions of lightsaber replicas for sale, some more realistic than others. When Yaguas has arrived, he realized he didn't know how to use it, so he went back online and found this school. The rest is history. Today, he's a three-time medal winner in an annual global tourney that draws combatants from around the world. To demonstrate his skills, Yaguas grabs his top student, Andrea Bonet, from today's training class. The two bow to each other, then light up, and the duel of the giant glow sticks begins. The combatants circle, then lunge, thrust and parry. They twirl and leap. It really looks like a scene from that other galaxy, the far, far away one, minus the costumes. As in traditional fencing, you get points for getting past your opponent's defenses and striking them with your saber.
Parecido a las artes marciales, pero es mucho más relajado. No hay como la seriedad y la...
This sport is similar to martial arts, but more relaxed, Bonet says, out of breath between rounds. Some folks dance around, she says, spinning their sabers through the air in what can look more like a light show than combat. She says she's more direct. Bonet skips the theatrics because that's not what drew her to the lightsaber. Amongst her colleagues, she admits she's an outlier.
Bueno, a mí no me gusta mucho Star Wars. No, no soy muy fan. Vine porque...
I don't even like the Star Wars movies, she says. I've seen the films, but they don't speak to me. I started because a friend invited me, and I loved it. I wanted to exercise, and I knew that if I signed up at a normal gym, she says, I'd never go. In the early days of the sport, combatants would dress up like their favorite Sith or Jedi or whatever. But the sport has evolved, says Yaguas. No one's in costume anymore. Still... I usually don't tell people when I first meet them what my passion is, he says. I'll say, I do a kind of fencing, which technically is true. Yaguas says he's never heard of a combatant who's impersonated a Jedi or other Star Wars figure and really believed it, you know, completely crossing over to the weird side.
Pero como todo deporte de competición, siempre hay el trastorno mental.
But he says, as with any sport, there are participants who suffer from a different mental delusion, thinking they're better than they really are, like the Dark Master himself.
Did you truly think that you could defeat me? You have failed, Master.
How wrong old Darth Vader was. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Barcelona.
And next, a prize that no scientist wants to give out, a glacier retreating fast enough to potentially break records. Just ahead, we learn about new research from Antarctica that may spell bad news for sea levels. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. When it comes to sea level rise, one of the big remaining questions centers on Antarctica. How long will it take for ice there to break off of glaciers and eventually melt into the sea? How fast that happens could drastically change predictions and planning timelines for coastal communities around the world. New research published this week about one particular glacier in Antarctica might provide some clues into that timeline. Glaciologist Ted Skambos is one of the study's authors. He told me the Hectoria Glacier on the east side of the Antarctic Peninsula retreated about 5 miles in just 2 months.
It looks like Hectoria was about 5 times to 10 times faster than the fastest previous retreats for glaciers like this in Antarctica, in Greenland, even in Alaska. Nothing that approached the speed of this retreat.
So glaciers breaking off into icebergs into the surrounding ocean, that is a normal process. It is just worryingly fast in some places right now, and this is very fast. Is that right?
That's exactly right. We're still understanding exactly how glaciers respond to things like tides and waves. All of those things impart forces and twists and strains on the ice that can lead to fairly rapid retreat. This was incredibly rapid, and it was an example of something that had been suspected from computer models but hadn't really been seen in detail before.
So tell me about that idea that scientists kind of feared as a potential worst-case scenario about what the fate of glaciers in Antarctica might be and how this finding relates to that.
A few years ago, there was an idea that came up that talked about this ice cliff failure as a way of accelerating how fast a glacier could retreat. So ice, it's not like rock. It's a solid, but it's much softer than rock. It doesn't have the strength to hold up a cliff the way the Grand Canyon can hold up a cliff thousands of feet tall. For ice, the limit is around 100 to 150 meters, 200, 300, 400 feet tall at the most. It immediately begins to fracture. It just can't hold up a cliff that tall sitting in the air, I should say, above the water.
So there's a limit to how tall a glacier can get, how tall an ice cliff can get.
That's it, exactly. Now, Hectoria's retreat was sort of one of the examples of how things might progress with a lower cliff in a simpler system when the ice is barely resting on the bed, just barely gliding over a muddy, slick bed on the ocean floor. That was revealed in spades. That process was revealed clearly in how Hectoria retreated. And it indicates that there are places in Antarctica that need to be watched, evaluated, sort of understood in terms of when they might go through the same kind of super rapid retreat. By the way, this doesn't just lead to icebergs on the ocean. The glacier behind this area that retreated so fast accelerated as part of this process. That plane of ice that fractured so quickly did provide some back stress to the glacier, and so when it broke apart, the glacier also flowed faster into the ocean and unloaded ice from the continent into the sea. That's the process that leads to sea level rise.
Right, and this problem of the physics of a very tall ice cliff, this is potentially going to be a problem as glaciers retreat to where they are much thicker on land instead of thinning out and being over the sea. So that's why this is a question we're worried about for the future. Is that correct?
Yeah, you're exactly right. The concern is that as climate warms, several things having to do with melting and flexing because of ocean waves and tides can break off the floating parts of the Antarctic ice sheet. If you lose those, yes, you're right. You get a much thicker column of ice right up against the ocean front. And the problem is that this fracturing can happen very rapidly, and that leads to faster flow for the remaining parts that are on the continent.
The common metaphor is the cork being taken out of the wine bottle and letting that ice or wine flow into the sea.
I came up with a slightly different one. I mean, if you were pushing a canoe into the ocean and it suddenly slips away from you, you're all going to fall into the water. And that's sort of maybe a better mechanical image for what's happening with ice flowing over bedrock and then going afloat.
That makes sense. The speed that you are documenting here of the calving of this glacier, it is remarkable for a glacier that is still in contact with the seafloor, grounded, as it's called. Now, some scientists say they do not believe that this was grounded at the time of this rapid retreat, which would make this finding much less unusual. You ascertain that it was, in fact, grounded. What is your evidence for that?
Yeah, we are pretty sure that it's grounded. Probably the best evidence is that as this rapid fracturing was occurring, there are several seismometers, earthquake monitors, set up in Antarctica, and they recorded weak seismic energy, not like a major earthquake, but seismic energy from the area right at the same time that this was calving. The other evidence that it's grounded is that the kind of calving that happens when ice is afloat, when thick ice is floating on the water and it breaks away, it very often breaks off in these table-like pieces. They're huge. That kind of calving stopped as this glacier began to retreat through the section that we're talking about.
You say that this gives us some information about bigger glaciers that might someday go through a rapid disintegration process, but how much can we actually learn from just this one example?
Well, I think this informs us that the models were onto something with this range of processes that can happen at the edge of a glacier that's sticking into the ocean. There's a range of them, some of them very scary, some of them kind of scary, like Hectoria. And now that we have begun to warm the planet so rapidly with greenhouse gases, we're seeing processes that we haven't seen before because we're pushing the planet in a direction it hasn't been pushed in before.
Ted Skambost is a glaciologist at the University of Colorado, Boulder.
Pope Leo XIV has been busy this week, so let's do a quick roundup of papal news.
Yesterday, the Pope fielded questions from reporters outside the papal retreat at Castel Gandolfo. When the topic of immigration in the U.S. came up, Leo called for a deep reflection about how the U.S. is treating migrants in detention. The Chicago-born Pope noted that people who have lived in the U.S. for years without any issues are being affected, and he said church ministers should be allowed to tend to their spiritual needs.
Something else the pontiff touched on in that Q&A was the peace accord between Israel and Hamas. That is significant as he prepares to receive the president of the Palestinian Authority, Mahmoud Abbas, at the Vatican tomorrow. Leo said the peace accord is fragile and the parties need to guarantee the rights of all peoples.
Pope Leo also has made a movement to tamp down on worship of Mary. He has approved a new decree clarifying that Mary is not the co-redeemer of the world. The decree stipulates that only Jesus should be called the Redeemer. The Vatican says appropriate titles for Jesus's mother include Mother of Believers and Spiritual Mother.
And those are some recent top headlines about Pope Leo.
You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It is not yet winter. Try telling that to professional skiers, though. For them, the season is well underway. And this season comes with new safety rules. Skiing is a dangerous sport, especially for professionals who careen downhill very fast. The World's Bianca Hillier brings us this report on the new regulations.
Adolfo Lorenzi only learned how to ski to keep up with his kids, who took to the sport as early as kindergarten near their home in northern Italy. All of the kids got really good, really fast, including one of his daughters, Matilde Lorenzi.
She was really putting all the efforts to reach a target.
That target was winning a World Cup, which is the top international circuit for alpine skiing. In 2024, the young Lorenzi was well on her way.
She was the Italian championship on Super Giant with a really unbelievable season.
She started preparing for the next season right away. But in October of last year, just before the season was set to start, she fell during a training run near the Italian-Austrian border. She was airlifted to a hospital, but soon died from her injuries. She was 19.
Well, Matilde, she was really a great, unbelievable great daughter. And We are, yes, we are really proud.
Hundreds of people attended her funeral, and the Lorenzi family started a foundation in her name to keep professional skiers safe.
Since the beginning, just the day after the accident happens, we decide with all the family all together that this was never the end of Matilde in the world.
In other words, her legacy would continue. But all too soon, the sport was mourning again. In April of this year, Margot Simon, an 18-year-old rising star on the French team, fell to her death in training. And Matteo Franchoso, a 25-year-old Italian, died after crashing while training in Chile in September.
You know, they can reach speeds of 80 and 100 miles an hour on some of these international courses. And everybody in our sport wants to improve and innovate so that these serious accidents don't happen.
Paul Van Slyk is a leading ski racing safety expert. He walks me through some of the new safety rules put in place by the sport's global governing body, known as FIS. For one thing, starting this season, cut-resistant undergarments are now mandatory across all events. That will help protect against sharp skis and crashes.
I've witnessed lacerations on the ski hill, and it's really, really scary. So I really am excited that this is taking place in our sport, that they're requiring this.
Another new rule is that everyone racing the fastest events, including downhill and Super G, now has to wear smart airbags. They fit like a vest underneath an athlete's suit, and they inflate during a detected crash before the skier hits the ground. They were originally used by motorcyclists, but about 10 years ago, they were introduced to professional skiers. In a statement to the world, the sport's global governing body, FIS, said between 30 to 60% of athletes have already been wearing the airbags voluntarily, including Lauren Masuga, a World Cup winner in Super G.
So the moment they offered airbags, I found them immediately. I don't believe you can go out and just casually train downhill. If you're going to go out and do downhill, you're going to put everything out there and you need to have the safety with you.
Not everyone is on board with the airbags, though. Here's safety expert Paul Van Slyk again.
There's definitely athletes that really don't want to wear the airbag because they think it's going to inhibit their performance and their aerodynamics.
It's also expensive. The Italian company that makes the airbags, Dianese, currently sells them for $1,700 each.
And as soon as that goes off, you have to send it back to the manufacturer to get it put back together. So the athletes probably need more than one of them, because if they deploy one, the next day they can't go back out again because it's required. So it's really expensive for the athletes and the teams.
Van Slyk says that he thinks part of the reason FIS is mandating the airbags is to help increase demand and lower the cost of production. One other sticking point for some athletes is that these new safety mandates are only applicable to competition, not training, where most of the fatalities from the past year have happened. Lindsey Vonn is one of the most decorated alpine skiers in history.
I think the biggest thing that we've noticed in the last few years is that the training needs to be safer. And you saw that with the death of the young Italian gentleman in Chile on the same track that I was training on the week before, which is, you know, really scary and definitely makes you realize how dangerous this sport really is.
FIS declined an interview request for this story, but in an email, they told me they're currently discussing mandating airbags in training, and they're going to spend the next 5 months conducting detailed audits of training courses worldwide to make sure they're safe. But before that deadline, the sport will be on the biggest stage of all, the Winter Olympics, which will be spread across northern Italy. For the Italian ski community, it will be both a celebration of the sport and a poignant moment to reflect on the tragedies of the past year. Adolfo Lorenzi says there will be an event to honor his late daughter, and the family plans to use the limelight to spread their message.
It will be a moment where everybody will have the eyes on the ski, and then it will be very, very important also for us to keep up the interest on the safety, because we cannot lose any efforts.
The Winter Olympics start on February 6th. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
It's safe to say most of us could use a laugh. Comedy is universal. Culture, though, is not. Still, Indian stand-up comic Veer Das believes that humor can transcend borders. He's a household name in India, and crowds of South Asian fans turn out wherever he goes. This week, he's doing a residency with three other comedians at New York's Lincoln Center Theater. Reporter Sushmita Pathak went to check it out to see how his jokes would play to non-Indians in the audience.
The audience is settling into their seats at the Lincoln Center Theater. As the music dies down and the lights dim, the crowd goes quiet.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Veer Das.
And then erupts in cheers. Veer Das has been a superstar in India for years. In 2023, he became the first Indian to win an international Emmy for his English language comedy. His latest Netflix special was filmed in Mumbai, London, and New York.
Like, okay, check it out. I'm not so Indian that I would study to be a doctor. No. But like, I'm Indian enough where I would never use a white doctor.
He is unapologetically Indian, and his jokes are rooted in India, but still draw global audiences. Like this couple, Gary Dundon and Sin Chi, who I met at the show in New York.
We've been fans of Veer Das for, what, a couple of years,
yeah.
I think, now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we try and catch him every time he's in New York. We drive him from Jersey, but, like, we really just enjoy his show because, like, I'm a first-gen immigrant, so what he talks about really resonates with me.
Das was raised in Nigeria, went to college in Galesburg, Illinois, and has worked in India as an actor and comedian. He's spoken about being a perpetual outsider. His memoir, which also came out this week, is called The Outsider. These experiences make global audiences connect with him.
I really like his Netflix specials where he talks to a different audience, but like every segment still connects. So like his jokes work really like globally, even though he says he's like not as funny because he's too global, so he's not relatable, but he's very relatable.
All right, cool. Now, just to establish the format of the show, you will notice we have guests with us this evening. In their very own special section, just like at the airport. Welcome, non-Indians. And what I'm trying to say is I love you guys very deeply, but they pay in dollars, all right?
Das says he doesn't think too much about whether his comedy translates. He wants to introduce audiences to something completely new, but still make them laugh.
You want to come into a comedy show and be entirely surprised and come out knowing things that you didn't know before the comedy show. So I do think that there is relatable comedy, and that's great for a certain kind of consumption. But I think I prefer comedy that introduces you to new worlds.
And thus, he wants to introduce India, specifically present-day India, in a way that both appeals to Indians and doesn't go over the heads of non-Indians.
We have had a long time of our stories being told for us, or some version of us being put out that doesn't represent sort of modern, audacious India. So I take pride in being an Indian voice that goes out to the world.
For a long time, Indian comedy in the West was limited to stereotypes and exaggerated accents. Think Russell Peters. Das's comedy, in contrast, feels refreshing, says fan Kanchan Barwani.
I feel that it's so out of the box, okay? Because he breaks out of the stereotypes of the whole typical brown comedy that usually, like, it really emphasizes our accents, our food, our aunties, uncles, our culture so much. Like, he breaks out of that.
While Das's fame has grown globally, he's also run into trouble back home. Das did a monologue in 2021 called Two Indias about the country's contradictions, which offended many supporters of the ruling party.
I come from which India? I come from two Indias. I come from an India where we laugh so loudly in the comfort of our own homes that you can hear us through the walls, and yet I come from an India where we break down the walls of a comedy club because you can hear laughter inside. I come from an India...
This is my voice. For better or for worse, this is my voice. And some people will be takers and some people will not be takers, but I can't alter this voice.
Das's residency is part of an initiative to bring new artists and new audiences to Lincoln Center Theatre. Maria Manuela Goyanis is the artistic director.
I'm so excited to see this kind of South Asian community come to Lincoln Center and feel like they belong at this theatre. And also, the most exciting thing is to have that audience with the theater-going audience, the more traditional theater-going audience, and see that interplay happen.
The performance is a cross between stand-up and storytelling. The theater is just 112 seats, which makes it feel like Das is almost talking to you one-on-one. He takes the audience on a journey, and above all, makes them laugh, just like he promises. Veer Das is performing at the Lincoln Center Theater till November 9th. For The World, I'm Sushmita Pathak, New York City.
Every year, thousands of people risk the dangerous journey across the Mediterranean, aiming for Italy and a new life in Europe. Many land on the Italian island of Lampedusa and abandon their boats there. Those boats are being given a second life through a prison workshop in Milan. Inmates at Opera Prison, one of Italy's largest, are turning migrant boats into musical instruments. From Milan, The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry explains.
In a small workshop on the outskirts of Milan, Enrico Alorto leans over a bandsaw and slices carefully through a coloured plank of wood. Alorto is a master luthier, and for the past 4 years, he's been teaching inmates at Opera Prison how to make string instruments like violins and cellos out of the wood of migrant boats that have been transported from Lampedusa.
It's important for an inmate to have a job, to earn money and to regain dignity. Second, it's a work that needs passion. It's very important, this kind of job.
A former prisoner, now out on probation, is hovering over a workbench nearby.
Come vedete, sono tutto rovinate, sono...
He shows me how he takes the wood from the abandoned boats and carves it into shape, always making sure to preserve the original paintwork. He doesn't want to say his name, for privacy reasons, he says. Just that he's originally from Ukraine and was sentenced to 10 years for robbery. When he was offered a job at the prison workshop, he turned it down at first.
Io posso dire che ero in una situazione disperata.
I was in a really bad way, he says. He was in a wheelchair because of health issues at the time, and he thought there was no way he could do the job. But Alorto, the master luthier, persuaded him to give it a go.
When I met him, he was on a wheelchair. He was depressed. He has been beaten in jail in his country, and so had very much trouble. I made a chair for him to work seated, and little by little, he's getting better.
The ex-prisoner says the work gave him hope. Maybe he could build a life for himself outside of jail, he says. The foundation behind the project is called Casa dello Spirito e della Arte, or the House of the Spirit and the Arts. Greta Corbella with the foundation says the previous Italian government was a fan of their work. Sometimes it helped pay the transport costs of moving the boats from Lampedusa to the prison yard, she says. But this government is not on board.
Io credo per un disinteresse, semplicemente non hanno, come dire, voglia.
They're not interested, she says. I think they don't care about this project. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has taken a tough anti-immigrant stance since coming to power almost 3 years ago. And those working with migrants and refugees say attitudes on the ground in Milan have hardened too.
E devo dire, prima dell'arrivo di Giorgia Meloni non avevo mai visto.
Modu Gay, who's originally from Senegal, says before Giorgia Meloni came to power, people didn't openly threaten violence against migrants or tell them to go back to their own countries. But that's all changed, he says. Gay runs a multicultural centre in Milan that brings migrants and locals together through music and educational projects. And he says the workshop at Opera Prison is a great initiative.
Io spero che un giorno non ci saranno più le barche che arriveranno in Italia.
But he says he hopes that one day migrants won't have to make those awful boat journeys and the instruments will just be a memento of the past. Back at the workshop, Nicolai, a 43-year-old prisoner from Romania, says it's impossible not to think about those migrants when you're carving instruments out of the boats.
Queste cose è impossibile non pensarle, no?
I know what it's like to go to sleep hungry as a child, he says. I can't imagine what desperation drives people to make these journeys. Last year, a group of professional musicians, known as the Orchestra of the Sea, performed at La Scala, Italy's most famous opera house, with the prisoners' violins and cellos. Nicolai, who's serving a 16-year jail sentence, was allowed to attend.
Sì, sono stato l'anno scorso, a febbraio dell'anno scorso, alla Scala, che sono la prima volta che sono entrato in un teatro così grande.
It was the first time I was ever in a theatre that big, he says. And suddenly, I felt like I was winning a battle, he says. A battle against himself. Enrico Alorto, the master luthier, says the concerts have been really moving for everyone.
The instrument contains the trouble of many people. And when the musician take the instrument, they are not good as the other instruments. They have to work to get the sound. But they understand there is something inside and get the emotion, and the public feels the same emotion.
The next step now is to find musicians or orchestras who will take our instruments to music halls around the world, he says, so we can show the public that out of so much suffering, something of beauty can be created. For The World, I'm Orla Barry. Milan.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. We wrap up today's show with a question. How do you scare away a ghost? The answers vary from culture to culture. Growing up in Steph Dahlwin's Vietnamese-American household, knives were an important part of ghost-busting. And now that she's become a stand-up comic, Dahlwin wants to joke about that. But getting the joke right has proven tricky because of her relationship with her Vietnamese background. She explained why for the storytelling project, Stories from the Stage, from GBH in Boston.
So I'm standing in the kitchen of my college dorm room, and I am panicking. I've got 8 people coming over in 20 minutes, and I don't have anything to feed them. See, I promised them a big pot of pho, the beloved Vietnamese beef noodle soup, and this should have been easy for me, like making a peanut butter sandwich. I had seen my mom make pho thousands of times growing up. The problem is, whatever I came up with didn't look anything like pho. It was this sad pot of gray beef water, like, oh God, it looked more like parboiled Martian. And I have some good friends, because they ate it anyway. But my God, I was so embarrassed. Like, how could I call myself Vietnamese if I couldn't make the one dish that everyone knew us for? There were times when I felt really disconnected from my Vietnamese heritage, and this was one of them. See, I'm actually biracial. My dad is Jewish, my mom is Vietnamese. I grew up knowing a lot about Judaism. I had a bat mitzvah, I went to Hebrew school, I wasn't allowed to eat bacon. My Vietnamese side, though, all I really knew is that we dipped a lot of things in fish sauce. And I had a lot of uncles and aunties who might not have actually been my uncles and aunties, but they always stayed for dinner and drank a lot of Hennessy. That night in my dorm room, I did something I hadn't done in years. I went to the kitchen, I got a knife, I put it under my pillow, and I went to sleep. Let me explain. When I was growing up, my mom actually used to sleep with a knife under her pillow, and she told me it was to scare away Vietnamese ghosts and evil spirits. 12-year-old me was fascinated, so I started doing the same thing. Now, I didn't sleep with a machete under my pillow like my mom. You know, I opted for a more sensible butter knife. But this knife was a portal to a whole other world. It was a way to feel connected to my identity in a way that I otherwise didn't feel I had access to. Eventually, I was discovered. But my mom let it slide. She didn't care that I was sleeping with a knife under my pillow, as long as it wasn't one of her good steak knives. It actually became something of a tradition between my mom and I. Whenever I'd come home from college, she'd leave a knife for me under the pillow. A few years later, I'm a brand new stand-up comic, and I knew I didn't want to talk about typical stand-up comic things, you know, my dating horror stories or my unsolicited thoughts on above-ground pools. I love those jokes, but they're not what I wanted to talk about. I wanted to joke about things that mattered to me, stories from my life, and I knew I wanted to write about this pillow knife. I workshopped this joke for months. I performed it in every dingy basement in the greater Boston area. I felt like it was finally ready, and I wanted to show it to my mom. She watches a video of me performing the joke, and she laughed. But then she very quickly changed the subject to, "Why are you wasting time with stand-up comedy? Where are my grandchildren?" That night, I'm sleeping at my parents' house. I go upstairs to bed. I reach under the pillow. No knife. I fly downstairs. "Mom, where's the knife?" "Oh, well, honey, I didn't think you liked it. I thought you were embarrassed of it, you know, because of that joke you told." I was devastated. I wrote that joke for her. But in that moment, I realized I had aimed my joke at the wrong target. Instead of aiming at myself, I pointed it at my mom, at my culture. So as painful as it was, that night, I got to work, scrapped the whole thing, and rewrote it. More months of testing, more dingy basements. I wanted my mom to see the joke again. I actually invited her to a show. I get on stage. I see my mom in the audience. I start to tell the joke. It went like this. "When I was growing up, my mom let me sleep with a knife under my pillow. To scare away murderous Vietnamese ghosts and all of my friends." At this point, I look out into the audience. I see my mom laughing. I keep going with the joke. You know, my mom actually called me the other night, and she was in a full panic, and she was like, "Stephanie, are you still sleeping with your ghost knife?" And I was like, "Yeah, obviously. I'm not trying to die." And she said, "Good, because Steph, I had a vision that there was this ghost man who was trying to abduct you and make you his ghost wife." I know. Isn't that crazy? Someone wants to marry me? I don't know why I'm trying to scare him. I need to trap him, okay? Forget the knife. Tonight, under my pillow, you're gonna see Heineken, Sports Illustrated, and half a sandwich, all right? At this point, I finish the joke. I look out into the audience. My mom is laughing. That night, I slept at my parents' house. I go upstairs, I reach under the pillow. The knife is back. And it wasn't just a butter knife, y'all. It was a steak knife. I had graduated. Knives are typically intended to keep people and ghosts at a distance. But in my case, a knife helped me feel closer to my mom, closer to feeling Vietnamese, and closer to feeling like enough. Thank you.
Steph Dalwin lives in Boston. Her story was produced by GBH's Stories from the Stage.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. You can also find our original reporting on YouTube. It's where you can also subscribe to our YouTube channel. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you, as always, for listening.
The World is supported by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. and by FJC, a foundation of philanthropic funds serving the nonprofit sector with donor-advised funds, fiscal sponsorship, bridge lending, and more. FJC.org. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. More information at theworld.org.